Okay, this is our final hour. Ken Hansen with us. That means your phone calls, the interactive portion of the program. Welcome back to Coast, Dr. Ken Hansen with us. Ken, how can the Bible through the book of Revelation be such a great predictor of future events?
Well, I just recently wrote a brand new ebook all about the book of Revelation as a prophetic text. It's called the Armageddon Code, and you can find it on my website, in fact, treasuresintime.org. And I look at it through a historical lens. I'm a historian, a Jewish scholar, and I see it as a real fulfillment, as it were, of those predictions in the mouth of Jesus that I was talking about. He saw it in his own day and time. He saw this ominous pangs of the Messiah beginning right then and there. And if you read the book of Revelation in tandem with what the ancient historian Josephus wrote about that horrible revolt of 66 to 70 of the common era, my goodness, it's chapter and verse exactly what was going on as over a million Jews died. But then I go on and I say, look, these indeed are archetypes. They're paradigms of tribulational periods that especially Jews relate to this, who have had a whole history and a legacy of woe and hardship and antisemitism and suffering right on through. The expulsion from Spain, of course, then in Poland in the 1600s, where 100,000 were massacred. People don't even know about that. It was a mini Holocaust foreshadowing Hitler. And now we see another possible, I hate to say even the word Holocaust, but that is what the enemies are threatening Israel with today. So the way to understand Revelation is to first understand its immediate historical fulfillment in the first century. 90% of it already had at least one fulfillment. But you see, there are multiple. If we can understand this innate human capacity of being able to get outside of ourselves, you know, see our future selves, which is a way of seeing the future.
Ken, since you've been doing this for how many years now?
Oh, my goodness, several decades.
Have you, all right, in these 30, several...
30 years at least.
Okay, in these 30-plus years, have you ever seen a time period that we have right now?
With this confluence of events?
With everything happening, yeah.
No. When I first went to Israel, it was as a young student. I was trying to finish up my BA degree, and I took a year to study abroad. I lived on Mount Zion in a place that had formerly been part of that no man's land until Israel conquered it, and all the landmines were cleared away. But I said that to say that as students, we were out all over the place looking at the archaeology, looking at these incredible antiquities, and we were especially in this quote-unquote West Bank territory. I went places that you wouldn't set foot in today, places like Hebron, which is easy to visit, the Tomb of the Patriarchs. It's a pretty dicey area nowadays. Shechem or Shechem, which is an incredible archaeological site. Even Jericho is a place you got to be careful about nowadays. It was really a peaceful era, in as much as at least you had the Israeli forces there. They were there was security. There was no separation wall. There were no knife attacks back in those days. And what the peace process has brought over the years is exactly the opposite. It's a scary thing to see it evolve the way it has. I've seen it the way it was, and I miss it. I'd like to say, if you want to understand America, take a history book. You want to understand Israel, take a shovel, because it's right there underneath your feet, this incredible ancient legacy. This was a rich Jewish land going back thousands of years to the days of Jesus and back even to King David. And then to see what has happened, the expulsion of this people, almost a complete expulsion of the Jewish people and scattering all over the world until their return. And yeah, I see that as a prophetic thing, the ingathering of the Jewish people back in 1947, 48.
All right, let's take calls for you, Ken. They are lining up, and the hour is ticking by. Let's go to Joel in Kansas City. Hey, Joel, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Mr. Norrie, I appreciate you taking my call. As always, I am a super fan of every topic that you have. And every now and again, I always have to call in to chime in. But with this topic, I have to say, back in the 60s and 70s, which I'm too young to experience, they were looking at individuals that were protesting the Vietnam War, civil rights, and what have you.
That's
and
right.
They were studying the organization of that, and they decided with certain individuals that are still in within the advisory of Barack Obama, like Kissinger and what have you, they figured out that the mass public was too educated on current events. And so when it came down to it, they decided that we needed to take the collegiates and maybe inform them into more of a persuasive look of how it would be better to support the democracy, if you want to use that term loosely. And I was wondering if your guest speaker thought that maybe that they looked at the eschaton as maybe a way to form the new world government, and by using the, I don't know what you would say, is maybe the madness of what they could push the average individual into and the upheaval, and try to make something better out of the chaos that they bring.
You follow that, Kenny?
Not terribly.
Okay, how about just a specific question, Joel?
If they make the world into the eschaton or the apocalypse, how well would they be able to shape it into their own form of one world government in the uppers versus the lowers? Do you feel like this is a manufactured apocalypse versus what it is written in the book?
Well, I'm old enough to remember the 60s and 70s and all of the unrest, and I'm old enough to remember the initial calls for one world government, and I tended not to pay a lot of attention to it. I tended to think this is a lot of hype. One world government, the United Nations, it's more opportunity just to scare ourselves to death. I've evolved there as well. And I am concerned about the international body, about the United Nations. I talked earlier about what the French have hatched in coordination, sadly, with our own government to try to impose a solution on the Middle East. This is being done through international bodies, and I am much more concerned about the idea, the concept of a one-world government that will obliterate literally the nationhood of the states that need to look after themselves. Every nation needs to take care of itself first and foremost. The United States certainly does. The state of Israel certainly does. When you have, and I hate to talk about conspiracies.
George,
I hear you there.
Yeah.
And I've evolved. I'm more receptive to this kind of talk. I have to be careful. But when you see international bodies that are in fact prepared to impose their will upon sovereign nation states who need to look out for their own selves, you're looking at a hornet's nest.
Yeah, you sure are. Okay, next up we go to Ed in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Ed, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, George, thanks for taking my call. And sure, Ken, just let me run this past you guys. Okay, now I do a lot of study out of the King James Version of the Bible. Now, I have it on audio CDs, which gives me the luxury of going back and forth through it. Now, in the book of Revelation, it states clearly, I mean, an elementary school kid could understand that there's going to be an antichrist, there's going to be a false prophet. They'll work as a dual team to deceive millions to lead them into hell. Now, the false prophet is going to put together the one world religion, and you're currently you've got a pope now that is in the process of organizing a one-world religion. Now, I don't say he's a false prophet, so don't misunderstand me, but he is organizing a world religion. Now, the Antichrist, I don't know who he'll be, but let me tell you this. When they ratify the peace agreement between the Israelis and what's left, now I'll say that word again, with what's left of the Arab nations, meaning there's going to be a nuclear conflict that's going to bring them to the peace table to ratify that peace agreement. And when that happens, you'll know then, if you're still here, now personally I believe in the rapture, but if you're still here then, that'll be the starting gun for the final 7 years. The first 3.5 years of that tribulation period will be a false peace. After that first 3.5 years, they'll go into what's known as the Great Tribulation. All hell breaks loose. Russia with the Persian army and what's left of the Arab nations will march against God and his forces, which will be Jesus Christ, Lord of Lords, King of Kings, our Lord and Savior, and Israel. Bear in mind, the whole Battle of Armageddon, the whole tribulation period is all about bringing the Jews back into the fold to know who their Messiah is. It just so happens it's going to affect the whole world, but that's what it's really all about.
All right, let's get Ken's take. Ed, you sound like a minister. Ken, what do you think?
Oh, boy. Well, I represent Judaic studies here at the University of Central Florida, so not particularly interested in converting the Jews to Christianity. What I do look at is trying to find common ground, and Jews historically have always shied away from end time and apocalyptic stuff. That's why I've been reticent even to go there. The idea is, look, if we take care of ourselves today, then the hereafter will take care of itself. We focus on the here and now, not the hereafter. We believe there's going to be a hereafter. That's part and parcel of the Jewish faith, but it will take care of itself. We focus on doing good, doing the right thing right now. That's always been the Jewish mantra, as it were. But as a scholar, I found that especially as we look back into texts, into ancient Jewish texts, we find an uncanny correlation between some of the apocalyptic notions in Jewish texts and what we find in Christian texts as well, and yes, in the book of Revelation. Now, they don't dovetail exactly, and that's why I look at them as symbolic. We've got this idea of 6,000 years in the Jewish faith. Then we have an idea not of 7 years, but 70 years. In fact, we have a medieval text called the Zohar. Maybe you've heard of the Zohar.
There was a movie called the Zohar, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Maybe it's the Zohan.
That's right, the Zohan.
Kabbalah is all over the Zohar. I call it Madonnaism. This is Jewish mysticism, and there is a lot of apocalyptic right in the heart of Jewish mysticism. And again, contemporary Jews don't go there, right? We're embarrassed to talk about the end, but it's there. And the Zohar predicts 70 years of troubles, these pangs of the Messiah, followed by 9 months in which the troubles will greatly increase. And then the last 45 days will be the most difficult of all. And Israel will be expelled out of Jerusalem into the desert of the nations. I'm literally quoting the Zohar now. And they shall eat salty roots out there. And some shall repent, but others shall be destroyed along with the nations. So this is uncanny kind of apocalyptic talk. And you're not going to find an exact correlation, which is why I think that the wise way to look at it is as patterns, as archetypes. Is it 7 years? Is it 70 years? Did it start with the Holocaust? Did it start with the creation of Israel? Maybe it hasn't started yet at all. Maybe we're entering another cycle. I think we need to be united in the sense of Christians and Jews standing together against these forces that would seek literally a civilizational conflict to bring us back to the 7th century or worse. And as far as the Antichrist, again, I would say Mashiach Sheker in Hebrew, which is a lying Messiah. And I like our caller's understanding of that, someone who would cry peace, who would pretend to bring us into peace. and yet it's just the opposite. But cycles of this. Go back to ancient Rome. Who brought peace more than the Romans, you see? They used to say Rome brought peace with a vengeance. They created a desert and called it peace. So that was their Antichrist. Who are we facing in our day? I dare not pin the tail on anyone, but I say we need to be wary. We need to look at the warning signs, and they're all around us.
Well, they sure are, but they're right under our nose in some cases, aren't they, Ken?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you. Pick up the newspaper. I used to hesitate to do that and look for apocalyptic signs in the daily newspaver. I thought, this is nuts. This is out there. And again, I'm a trained scholar, so we have to be very rational. But hey, even trained scholars have a right to be scared, and I am. I'm scared for my future, my family, my own children. What kind of world will they inherit? But this is all avoidable, again. The same passages in the Zohar, this mystical book, declare that in the 600th year of the sixth millennium, the gates of wisdom will be opened. So that's a very rosy thing. And if you calculate all that out, it would come to the year 1840, which corresponds basically with the onset of the scientific revolution. The gates of wisdom will be opened. And my goodness, has life changed on our planet since then?
Oh, yeah.
We have in our hands to go either way. And the ancient Jewish prophets, again, they said, these pangs can be avoided. This Messiah, son of Joseph, will either go out to war and be killed in war, or can avoid it entirely. It's in our hands.
Ken, the mindset of a suicide bomber, what the heck are they thinking?
Monotheism can do strange things to people. And I speak as a monotheist. Most of the world is not monotheistic, but there are three great faiths that are: Judaism, Christianity, Islam. And there's a downside to all of them. And that is intolerance. I hesitate to say, but it's there and has been in all of the monotheistic faiths. Even ancient Egypt's version of monotheism, Pharaoh Akhenaten, was notoriously intolerant of others. Those monotheists who try to correct it are the wise ones. But there's still that strain that says we're right because we're monotheists, we serve the one God and none other, and therefore all others are doomed, and if they don't get it, we'll help them along a little, and we'll wipe them off the map ourselves. It's an aberrant form of Islam, to be sure, but it carefully, as we know, twists the Quran and distorts it and creates a type of jihad of intolerance that wasn't even intended in the heart of Islam. Jihad is supposed to be an internal struggle with ourselves, and they turn it into a holy war.
And ugly, too. Ken, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Jimmy Church will be filling in for me tomorrow. I'm in St. Louis. I'm going to do a little family thing tomorrow night, and Jimmy is gracious enough to sit in, but he'll also be on Saturday as well. Quickly, these weeks just keep flying by, so make sure you're part of Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dr. Ken Hansen with us. We'll get to your calls, too. Ken, these events, these apocalyptic events, these cycles, are they cycles that will be or can be? Can we change them?
We can change them. And this is all over the Jewish writings. We talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse: war, famine, pestilence, death. But in the ancient Jewish writings, there are four parallel reverse characters called the four craftsmen. People don't know about them. Elijah, the Messiah, son of Joseph, Messiah, son of David, and a mysterious character that Jews don't even know about called the Righteous Priest, but he appears in the Dead Sea Scrolls. This character actually would purify from disease and pestilence. That's one of the four horsemen. Messiah, son of David, brings about resurrection of the dead. That's opposite the death horseman. The Messiah, son of Joseph, wages war. Well, that's one of the four horsemen. And Elijah appeared during a terrible drought and famine, but he ended it. And again, we're in this Passover season, Easter season, and there's a very curious apocalyptic aspect to the Passover meal every year. At the very beginning, an empty place setting is set for the prophet Elijah, in case he shows up tonight. And at the end of that Passover meal, every single Passover Seder, and it'll happen again this year, someone goes to the door and opens it to see if Elijah has come to this home tonight. And that's when the final glass of wine is raised, and everyone says together, L'shana haba'a b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. This is apocalyptic stuff. Elijah is the one who will herald in this messianic age, the Messiah. But which Messiah will it be? The suffering Messiah and the pangs of the Messiah, or this triumphant son of David? And we have both images in the ancient prophets.
But we don't know which one it will be.
No, we don't. And that's where Judaism is a little bit unique and differs somewhat from Christianity, because it says that everything, there's a saying in Judaism, Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirat shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven or God, except the fear of God. So everything is predestined except our own condition.
Ken, are you familiar with Rabbi Schneerson, that story?
Oh, yes. Oh, my, yes.
Is he supposed to be like a Messiah?
His followers don't talk about that, although many believe that he was, many still believe that he is. There are groups of Schneerson's organization called Chabad. They're all over the world. They're all over the United States. They're on college campuses. We have one here at the University of Central Florida. I know the rabbi quite well, Orthodox, of course. He will not talk, of course, about whether or not Schneerson was the Messiah, but many believed that he was. Some to this day believe that he will rise again and return as this Messiah, son of David. And the rabbi himself, Schneerson, declared that the messianic age is imminent. Even though we have this 6,000-year cycle, we're not there yet. We still got a couple hundred years to go. But the declaration is, okay, 224 years to go, but the Messiah will come before that year. He could come any day, any moment. When will the Messiah come? They asked the rabbi. Any day.
All right, to the final calls now we go. Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, get us going here.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good.
Yes, Mr. Hansen, I'd like to ask you now, what do you believe about Armageddon? Will it encompass and engulf Jerusalem? Years ago, I read about the Jerusalem syndrome, that the vow that the CIA has and the plans that they have to protect Jerusalem no matter what.
I wish we had a plan to protect Jerusalem. Maybe we do. No matter what. Theoretically, that's our position. But right now, our position is to divide Jerusalem. And if you want to bring on Armageddon, that's the way to do it. I've been to Armageddon, as I'm sure many in our audience have. You just go take an Israel tour, and they will take you to this vast plain of Jezreel, where once upon a time the Roman army encamped prior to its final assault on the city of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That's why I say these things are cyclical. They've happened before. Armageddon happened then. It happened within a generation of Jesus' prophecy. Will it happen again? Again, that's what's in our hands. I wish we had this vow to protect Jerusalem, but the way we're going, I think it's just the opposite. The plan is to divide it. Divided cities don't work. You want to bring on we're in World War III, but you want to make it a hot war, divide Jerusalem.
That'll do it. And there are Jews who will have a civil war against the state of Israel, in fact, civil war in Israel, if a decision is made to divide the city of Jerusalem. This is an eternal capital. And you want to end it. You want to have the rosier scenario. Hey, the Israelis need to come together and say, look, we are here. We're not going anywhere. Deal with it. That'll end it.
What's the situation, Ken, with the dome?
The Dome of the Rock, where I used to go many times back before the peace process, when we actually had peace. It sits right on top of a rocky outcrop. All kinds of scholarly debate about whether, in fact, the ancient Jewish temple stood on that precise rock. That's why they call it the Dome of the Rock. It's bedrock. And I can't go inside anymore these days, but I used to all the time, back before the peace process, and you see these indentations in the rock, and I never knew what they were. You know, just some grooves or carvings of some kind. Was the temple exactly in this spot? Well, a very brilliant scholar was able to actually take measurements, take photographs from the very top of the dome, measure the whole thing out, and lo and behold, he discovered that those indentations in that rocky outcrop exactly match the dimensions in the Jewish Talmud, the Jewish writings, of the Ark of the Covenant. And that convinced me, actually. I think that this was the resting place in the original Temple of King Solomon of the Ark of the Covenant. Wow! It means that the dome sits right where the temple stood. And what are the implications of that? There have been for quite some time some rather radical groups that have talked about, let's say, dismantling or blowing up the Dome of the Rock. Jeez. Not anything I would advocate, but there's another reason for apocalypse right there. Let's rebuild the temple.
Next up, Cameron in Santa Maria, California. Hey, Cameron, go ahead.
Hi, George. Good to hear you tonight.
You too.
William Casey said in one of his books, or in one of the books about him, that the Cold War was World War III. So we're either in World War IV or worse. And I'd like to say that all you have to do is hug your neighbor, shake his hand, shake her hand, more kissing among the women, try to get along, let the aggression drop down, work together. Martin Luther King said, we can all work together as brothers, or we can all perish together as fools.
You know, I love that. I love that. And this is so Jewish. And the ancient sages talked about seven basic laws for all humanity. Of course, Jews have a whole lot of laws that must be fulfilled, but just seven. And they have to do with exactly the things that you mentioned: respect for human life, respect the Creator. You want to avoid this apocalypse, practice these laws. And yes, the sages said exactly that. As for World War III or IV, my favorite quotation is from Albert Einstein. He said, I know not what weapons World War III will be fought with, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones.
Well, he was right about that, telling us that the apocalypse would be a disaster of biblical proportions, Ken.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I love our call. I mean, there's two messages. There's this wonderful, bright future that we really can have if we know what to do, how to approach it, how to love our neighbor, and, by the way, stand with Israel.
Roger in Orlando, Florida now. Raj, go ahead.
George, Professor, behold, Elijah is calling in right now. Ha. If you will believe it.
Well, hello, Elijah.
Listen, I think I have the theory of relativity, sublimely simple solution to producing a new world. And basically the problem is group thinking. Human beings are conditioned to think in groups, and groups villainize one another. They're naturally guarded against one another, and they perpetuate structural violence from history. So this is the basic problem that the human community have right now. And the solution to this is to institute a new consciousness where we reduce society to the level of the individual's conscience. We give the individual the authority to live by his conscience, not to identify with groups and momentums of violence from the past, but to take to be a center of his own conscience, to be respected as such. And this would free all people's creativity, and it would institute an entire new world. And I saw a wonderful quote on a Facebook page. It's called New American Spring Facebook page, and it's right here in Orlando. It's I don't know if your USF is UCF is here in Orlando.
Yes,
but there's a movement starting here in Orlando. It's called New American Spring on Facebook.
Social networking does a lot of this too, Kenny.
Yeah, and you're talking like a Kabbalist there. You're talking like one of the Jewish mystics. There's a center of Jewish mysticism to this day, right in the heart of Israel, in this wonderful city called Safed or Tzfat, up in the hills of Galilee. And there's a lot of thought about new consciousness and developing a sublime consciousness, going up through the divine sefirot, as they're called, the manifestations or emanations of the divine spirit. Oh my goodness, you can talk for hours about that. But one starts at the lowest level, called Shekinah, and enters that, and is successively drawn up into higher and higher levels toward a universal consciousness called Keter or crown, which is concomitant with the eternal being, the eternal presence, very mystical kind of stuff. But I love the direction of all this. On the one hand, you have this horrible foreboding of what really could engulf our planet in disaster, in a serious Armageddon. But then you have other pathways that are real peace, not a lying peace, but a real peace. And it's up to us.
We've got Pete in Ontario, out there in Canada. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, I'd like to ask Ken again the name of the city that he figured ISIS was holed up in. I didn't recognize it. It started with an R, and it's
Rafah.
Pardon me?
Rafah, in Iraq.
That is in Iraq.
Yes.
Would you suggest cluster bombs, phosphorus? What was your plan there with the carpet bombing? What comes to mind is the line in the last bumper music, I only want to be with you. The line was,
yeah.
And a chance, and I was thinking of the women and children that you wanted to wipe out.
We don't want to wipe out women and children, hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, fortunately, I'm not a general, but that's why we need our generals, right? And that's why, and here, concomitant with this, these wonderful promises of what the future can be, we have to face the reality that is. We have to face a World War III that's already broken out. How did we fight World War II? I mean, yeah, there are going to be civilian casualties. You have to be prepared to carpet bomb. Of course, you don't want to inflict collateral damage, and our military can do it a lot more accurately than we used to be able to. That's clear, but a few sorties a day is not enough, and this threat is metastasizing.
If you sent out flyers, let me ask you this, Ken. You sent out flyers to that city,
yeah,
and you simply said, "We are going to level this city in a week. You must leave, please."
Yeah.
Let's assume the men, the women and children would leave. Would ISIS stay behind thinking that it was a hoax, or would they leave with them, leaving an empty city? And if they do, you win that too, don't you? Because you've gotten them out of that city.
Well, you got them out of that city. That's true. That is true. So, you know, the humanitarian in me would like to drop flyers. And also, by the way, there's one country on this earth that really has dropped flyers when it's about to strike terrorists, and that's the state of Israel. What country drops flyers in advance saying, "We're about to strike, innocents need to get out of here"?
Please,
the state of Israel does that.
So I don't know. I don't know, where would the ISIS fighters go? Are they now in that city, living amongst the people, sleeping in the houses and huts and everything else?
Yeah, they are. But they are under attack, and as I say, they are losing ground now, and it's a pretty catastrophic withdrawal for them. That's why they're going to ramp up terrorism elsewhere, and it's tentacles. You know, you stomp them out in one region,
they show up someplace else,
somewhere else. You know, now of course Libya is becoming a more of a nest for them. So it is an international problem and a blight, and we have to be resolute enough. We have to go back to the way we used to fight wars. Where is General MacArthur? Where is General Patton?
Said keep Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi in their respective countries.
Sure.
They might have said that.
By the way, the way conflicts are resolved and all through history is that one side wins. That's it. One side wins. And we need to have the resolution to win. And as I say, even in Israel itself, there's a lot of knee buckling now. And maybe if we just give in and surrender, this doesn't help. It makes it worse.
It does. Ken, if people want to download your books, you've got some e-books. Where do they go?
Head to my website, treasuresintime.org, and it's linked on Coast to Coast AM. There's also links to my brand new YouTube channel. What I'm doing as a professor is making what we teach here in Judaic studies available to the general public. We teach web courses more and more, but I've created actual video episodes of what I teach, and they're beautifully done and crafted with marvelous editing. They're like television shows. And I've got entire courses now on the YouTube channel that it's called Treasures in Time also.
Good for you.
But again, and it's about, we have one called Judaism and Jesus, which is fascinating. I'm creating one on ancient Israel, and I've got another one on the history of the
Holocaust. You keep doing what you're doing. Ken, enjoy your Passover. And those of you who are of the Christian faith, enjoy your Easter this weekend. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.